Well, there is. You can just start. We'd like to get started as soon as possible, so if people can sit down and come in, and we only have an hour for this presentation, and we're eating it up here. Thank you all for being here in a timely way.
So full. Thank you. I did change the background. Oh. What's up, everybody?
Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to get started now. I just want to first say I hope you all enjoyed your lunch and you had some great conversations. Hope you all enjoyed your lunch and that you've had some great conversations over lunch. I know I never want to leave the lunch table, so I'm usually one of the late stragglers. But what we're going to do today is cover some of the sort of components of the best practices in analytics. Obviously, we have less than an hour. We can't cover a lot about analytics, but I think the topics that have been chosen, as Denise mentioned, were chosen based on input from you all in the survey. So we're hoping that they will really meet your needs. I'm not going to go through bios. I'm going to just ask each of the panelists to say like a word or two about themselves and where they come from. But we're really delighted today to have some great people and some great topics. So we're going to cover patient attribution. Let's see. Where's my pointer here? And Joe Porter's going to do that. And then we're going to go to alternative payments, and Kathy Hines will be reflecting on that. And then the last topic is consumer tools, and Karen Lee. I had a little trouble with her name earlier. Karen Lee will be talking about consumer tools. Then we'll have some opportunity for questions. And if you all don't have questions, I have some in my back pocket to that they don't even know about to ask them. So let's get started. I should probably say who I am. I'm Barb Rudolph. I've worked with Natto for about 8 years under contract, and before that was a member of Natto and a board member and a fan of Natto. So it's a delight for me to be here once again, and I think I only missed one Natto meeting since 1994, I believe, was my first Natto meeting. And it was my first week on the job as the Deputy Director of the Office of Healthcare Information in Wisconsin. And it was eye-opening and frightening at the same time as you come into a new position and think about all the things you need to learn. But Natto staff and the other members were just so helpful all the way along. So. Well, let's get started. I'm going to turn it over to Jo.
Great.
And she's going to talk about patient attribution.
Thank you. So I feel like I've introduced myself four times today, but my name is Jo Porter. I'm with the University of New Hampshire, and I'm also with the APCD Council, but I am wearing my UNH hat today, in that our work around APCDs largely started with an interest in using New Hampshire's data for a number of health policy projects within our state. So in addition to the APCD Council role, I'm also the Deputy Director of the Institute for Health Policy and Practice at the University of New Hampshire. And in that role, we have a health analytics unit that's been using New Hampshire data, APCD data, for a number of projects. And I'm going to talk a little bit about one of those projects and some of the methods that we've employed within that project, particularly around attributing patients to primary care. We have a number of cost and quality reports, more cost and utilization reports, although we are developing quality reports, that are seeking to look at a population that's been attributed to primary care and some comparative information about populations that have not had a history of primary care. And also within this project, I should mention that the work was funded through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in a payment reform grant that we have at UNH, that we had at UNH, that we continue to work on. That we have a cluster of provider organizations within the state who are working towards accountable care arrangements in one form or another. And the goal of the project was to attribute patients within the data to practices within our our accountable care project, and also to have a comparative look at patients who were attributed to primary care in organizations not within those that were participating in our project. So I'm not going to go into a lot more detail about the project other than to say that the patient attribution component of what I'm talking about is largely attributing patients to primary care experience based on the data that we have available to us in the All Payer Claims Database, for the state of New Hampshire is known as the Comprehensive Healthcare Information System, or CHIS. So in general, as I was saying, the crux of the project is to attribute members who have primary care experience to a physician or other primary care provider, not just physicians, but we also have nurse practitioners and physician's assistants and others within the model of attribution to primary care. Generally, the components of the work include the identification of primary care physicians, largely based on taxonomy codes, and I'll talk a little bit about that, but also the identification of primary care services that based on visit types, and then the attribution of a patient to a provider based on the experience of the patient with a provider, with some factors for selection for which provider they get attributed to in case they have primary care experience with more than one provider. So just generally, each unique member is attributed to a provider. For the participating practices in the Accountable Care Project that I mentioned, providers are also attributed to practices, or their providers are clumped together, if you will, as a group of providers providing primary care, not associated with any individual group practice, but as a comparator group. And then we also have a population designated that has no attribution to primary care at all. So for provider identification itself, we rely heavily on the NPI and also the payer-specific provider identification numbers. We have a phase of the project that focused in on those NPIs themselves, recognizing that there are gaps in NPI, but also recognizing that there are mechanisms by which you can use some of the information within the data to assign NPIs in the cases where they're missing. I won't talk a lot about that work as part of this project just for the sake of time, but I'm happy to have those conversations if folks are interested. And we have NPI lists for the practices that are part of our project that were given to us by the practice sites, which is a big barrier for a lot of folks, is figuring out that provider to practice link is something we've talked a lot about. We didn't have to deal with that because we got the provider list from the practices themselves. But then we had this cluster of all of the other primary care providers that were not as part of our practice sites that we keep together as a group of primary care providers. So as I mentioned, the definition of primary care is based on two major factors, which is provider taxonomy and visit type. So using the NPI and the taxonomy information that comes from the NPI database, we defined certain providers within the model that deliver primary care services, and we also defined a set of services that we use as primary care, based on the procedure codes and the visit types. I should say, partly out of recognition, but also for feeling better about the methodology, that this particular component of the project was determined by a data and methodology user group that we convened that included both clinical perspectives, but also a number of administrative perspectives from the clinical setting. Which was incredibly helpful as we thought about what sorts of providers should we talk about, what sorts of visit types would you want to use, and that sort of thing. And the goal was to create a methodology that we would be able to use, perhaps with some tweaking, that would be fairly consistent between commercial Medicaid and Medicare data. That little bit of tweaking included things like there are certain visit types that are highly used in Medicaid, particularly at the community health center level, that aren't really reflected in the commercial data, so we needed to add visit types that were unique to some of the data sets, but in general, the methodology holds pretty consistently across the three data sets. So again, as I mentioned, we use the taxonomy codes from the NPI database that are established by the National Uniform Claims Committee. So we use the NUCC taxonomy codes. Interestingly, you know, as folks who use the NPI database know, there's not necessarily a huge push for the providers to keep those things up to date, and we know that there are some gaps around that. So one of the things that we were pretty happy about as we went through this is that we got NPIs, as I mentioned, from all of our practice sites, which included a lot of providers and some very large practices. And when we ran the NPIs that they gave us up against the taxonomies in the NPI database, they were very consistently primary care providers. We saw one podiatrist, and so we were like, okay, we'll deal with this one noise, but we felt very good about the quality of what we were seeing otherwise. I don't really think he's going to count in the primary care taxonomy, but you know, we could argue that, and luckily we didn't. And we also established two tiers of providers. So this is just a bad rendering. Sorry, the formatting came off. But we, again, created taxonomy code. We looked at taxonomy codes, pulled the taxonomy codes into the data based on the NPI, and came up with a list of tier one and tier two providers. This is not an exhaustive list of everybody that was included, but gives you a sense of it. So we have a set of what we call tier one providers that are always in primary care, and then a tier two set that basically says if you don't see any activity with a tier one provider, these provider types with the right visit codes can be considered primary care in the absence of services with other providers. And then, in addition to that, we also looked at the visit types, also in two tiers. And for the visit types, we used the CPT codes that the AMA maintains and had a very similar design. There was a cluster of, you know, as we like to call them, the 9920 codes that are that indicate office-based visits. So again, there was a tier one. Any of these visits count for primary care. In the absence of any of those visits, you could move to tier two and count those as primary care visits. And I should say that in the review that we did, most of the categorization to primary care was done based on the tier one methods for both providers and visit types. We didn't use tier two as much. And then for the actual patient attribution, the process is looking through the claims of that individual and attributing them to a provider who renders the majority of their primary care services, looking at both the provider type and the visit type of their experience in the claims. And then summarizing across time, depending on what we use 12-month periods, counting, essentially summarizing encounters at the provider member date level. So that quantified an encounter, and then counting those encounters such that the largest visit count attributed a member to a provider. In the event of a tie on visit counts, we went to the most recent visit. And in the event that we had a tie, so somebody had, you know, two visits with two different providers, and one of them was on the same day, we would have gone to largest allowed amount. The reality is we never got there. We didn't have anybody who had that situation. And very rarely did we actually have to go to dates. So for the majority of folks, counting those encounters was the method we used for that attribution. And what you see on screen here is then a look at the data analysis that we're using with those groupings. So in the, I don't know if this is a little pointer thing. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So in the upper left-hand corner are all of the members attributed to primary care providers that are within our project. And then there's the cluster of people who are attributed to primary care not within our project, and what you can't see in the drop down here is that there's also a not attributed group. What we ended up seeing for New Hampshire, which I think is not surprising given the way that New Hampshire actually has very good access to care for the most part, is we didn't have very many people who didn't attribute, particularly in the commercial population. They're a very small and inexpensive group. We were a little concerned that what we might see is a very small and very expensive group, owing to them seeing primarily specialist care and not a lot on the primary care side, and that was why they didn't attribute. But for the most part, what we saw was it was a very inexpensive group of people, which indicates to us that they're probably people who just don't receive care at all. And our analysis now looks at these folks and comparing their cost and utilization characteristics for those in our project, for those not in our project, and also for those who have no primary care. So that's a 4-minute patient attribution in a nutshell.
Before you go on to the next.
Sure.
Just a question about, do you have available any greater documentation of the
Yes,
process?
Thank you. That's that website at the bottom. So the report that I just showed online, this is a screenshot of a reporting tool that we have in place that takes the methodology that we used, as well as all the methodology on the analytics side, to define the cost and utilization reports. The website is nhaccountablecare.org, and anybody can go to that site. We have site-level reporting for the partners who are within our project, but we also have public-level reporting for the regions in our state, and this was actually one of the things that was really helpful for our sites, is that many of them are looking at their regional approaches to care. So if you click on the button that says Access Public Reports, you can get to what I just showed you. And within that, there's methodology description of both the reports that are included in the suite, you know, definitions of numerators and denominators and those sorts of things, but also a detailed look at the attribution methodology, including all of the visit codes that we use, all of the provider taxonomies that were included, what that tier looked like, and some breakdown on the NPI work that I mentioned as well. You.
Great. Okay, can everyone hear me? Yes? Okay, good. So I'm Kathy Hines. I'm the Director of Data Compliance and Support at the Center for Health Information and Analysis, otherwise known as CHIA, in Massachusetts. My topic today is to talk a little bit about alternative payment methods, how they fit in with the All Payer Claims database, and how Massachusetts reports on APMs using analytics. Massachusetts payers are required by regulation to report to CHIA data on changes in types of payment methods implemented by the payers and the number of members covered by alternative payment methods. So where is Massachusetts in alternative payment methods? By our current reporting methods, we have established that approximately 34% of healthcare in Massachusetts is paid for from an alternative payment method, which means the other 66% is the traditional fee for service. The majority of the alternative payments falls within the HMOs. And you can see listed on this slide a publication by CHIA that's posted on our website if anyone's interested. That talks about the alternative payments. Over the past 2 years, the percentages have remained fairly flat. However, nationally, per the Catalyst for Payment Reform group, Massachusetts is well above the national average for alternative payments. So how are we approaching the analysis of alternate payments? We're particularly interested in global payments, limited budget payments, and bundle payments with and without either financial or quality incentives included. CHIA collects this data in two ways. The first is the annual aggregate data submission, and now we've started to do some collection of this data in the All Payer Claims database. So the aggregate data APM reporting to CHIA is based either on provider level or zip code level. So for the provider level, each payer provides a breakout by insurance category, product type, and payment method, the member months and the total claims payment, the total non-claims payment, and also payments due to financial performance and quality. And on the zip code level, the payers provide for each zip code by insurance category and product type and payment method, the member months, a health status adjustment score, which is basically illness burden, and total claims payment. So on this screen, you can see some of the values that we do collect. Again, it's at an aggregate level, and we've done quite a bit of reporting and analysis based on this aggregate data. So our challenge became, how do we get more information from the All Payers Claim database on alternative payments? In November of 2012, we started working on this, looking at using the All Payer Claims database to completely take over the aggregate method. And we went through a huge undertaking developing rules for submitting a bunch of non-claims payments at the provider level, looking to collect health status scores at the member level, non-claims payment for incentive programs by provider, thinking that we could bucket providers, that this provider does everything on a global payment, this one does everything on a bundled payment. And what we found was it doesn't work. It doesn't happen that way, and the payers don't collect the data that way. So what we did know is that the services rendered under the All Payer Claims base are coming into the APCD. The bundle payments definitely come in. Even the global payment methods, if they're under a risk adjustment program, they're coming into the All Payer Claims database. The members, regardless of how it's getting paid for, are coming in under APCD. The dollars and cents of it, the charges and the payments, that's a little more difficult because that isn't necessarily line level. It might be tied to a provider or it might be tied to an incentive based, but we are getting some information on that. So our alternative, after much collaboration with the payers and our stakeholders, was to collect some very useful information to be able to bucket claims and members and providers into broad categories for alternative payment method analysis. What we started collecting at the end of 2013, as shown on this screen, was payment arrangement types for the provider, the member, a global budget indicator on the member, and PCP information and practice group information for the members. So the data started flowing in as of November, and which is great. But what we found was before we could actually start moving into payment analysis, we had two other challenges we had to work through. Claims versioning. We don't get just one version of a claim. We get multiple iterations of a claim. We had to work with the payers to determine how to find the highest version of that claim or how to roll up the claim. We undertook quite a bit of work, a lot of individual meetings with payers to get to a logic for that, and we accomplished that last year. Then on the membership side, we had to be able to count the belly buttons, know who was assigned to each payer and how they fell under that payer. So again, extensive analysis. We worked with our Division of Insurance and some internal stakeholders. We get an aggregate data collection method from the payers at CHIA. And we actually did road trips with the Division of Insurance. We went out to each one of the payers and said, okay, you're reporting to the Division of Insurance this way. You're reporting to us this way. There's differences. Why? And by doing that, we were able to understand the differences, explain the differences. In some cases, it was that they weren't reporting what they thought they were to the Division of Insurance. In some cases, we had to tweak our logic a little bit on how we were bucketing. In some cases, they found that there was something that they needed to change in the way they were reporting to the APCD. End result, we tied out almost completely with our top payers to the Division of Insurance and our numbers. And now the payers feel comfortable with us moving forward in reporting membership numbers from our data. And that will allow us to get to the next, moving into payment analysis. Now we can find the final version of the claim, we know who the members are for that payer, and we can start to work on the payment analysis. And it will follow similar to what we did with these two projects, where we will work with the payers to look at what they're submitting to us on alternative payments and use the data that we get in the APCD, not necessarily to tie out, because there are pieces that won't be there, but to understand it better and to be able to report on it. So that's my nutshell in 6 minutes or so, where Massachusetts is in alternative payments. As I said, we're at about 34%, which is excellent. And there is quite a bit of analysis work done that is on our website. So if anybody wants to see some of the numbers and where that 34% came from, by all means, go out to our website, www.mass.gov/CHIA. And that's it. Welcome. Let's go on to this.
Okay, what button? Okay, good afternoon. My name is Karen Lee Harrington, and I'm with the Maine Health Data Organization. And I'm thrilled to be here today, so thank you, Denise and Joe, for pulling this all together. I'm personally happy to be here, because for the last 2.5 months, I've been locked in a room redrafting rules that will govern how we release data going forward. And a big reason behind that is because of some new legislation that was just passed in the state of Maine, which is very exciting for us, and I'd be more than happy to talk with anybody about that offline. So it's great to be around people. I haven't showered for a couple months. It's been brutal. But anyways, I'm here today to spend about 5 minutes talking to you about what we're doing around consumer tools, and or what consumer tools we have and some of the activity that's going around or going on in terms of enhancing those tools. And before we get started, this is kind of a, I don't know if you can all see it, but we are really working at branding ourselves. Because I can't tell you how many times I talk to people and they say, what is the Maine Health Data Organization? We've been around since the 1990s, in the state of Maine. Maine has had a long history of looking at data and using data, right, to make decisions and so on and so forth. But a lot of people don't know, and when I say a lot of people, consumers, right, as we traditionally define consumers, have no idea what we do, and they don't know the tools that are available. So that's a big part of our job ahead of us over the next couple of years, working with our partner, Human Service Research Institute and NORC, to really define these tools and to build consumer awareness. And so one way we're starting is to brand ourselves with information, insight, and improvement. And I'm not sure that that is consumer friendly. I'm sure our consumer advisory group will tell us it's not. So look forward to their feedback. We'll talk about more of that in a minute. But we really believe information will lead to insight, which will lead to improvement. And that's what we're all about. So with that said, okay, if I found the pointer, Joe, but I can't find the, okay. All right, so Maine Health Data Organization, as I said, established in 1995. We're an independent executive agency, which means I don't serve at the pleasure of a governor, but I serve at the pleasure of a multi-stakeholder board. The multi-stakeholder board has representation from hospitals, providers, employers, consumers, payers, government. And when you bring all those people together and you ask them, what does transparency mean? How do you define a consumer? You do not get the same answer. And so it creates a whole lot of challenges. And we'll get into some of that in a minute. The purpose of the agency, it was created by the legislature to create and maintain a useful, objective, reliable, and comprehensive health information database. Crazy that, right, all those things, how do you do all of that? And what do some of those terms mean? And so we have been working very closely with a data user group that has been helping us to define what some of those things mean. We can say those words, but having a definition of what that means has been really important for where we want to go. And the database is supposed to be used to improve the health of Maine citizens and to promote transparency of the cost and quality of healthcare in the state of Maine. And we're supposed to do that in conjunction with an agency called the Maine Quality Forum, which I also run. So it's good because I am working with both these agencies, and we work very closely on integrating cost and quality. What the Maine Health Data Organization has created many, many years ago under the leadership of Al Przunka is the health cost website. And I think you've probably heard about this over the years. And what we're doing is working with HSRI to enhance and take this to the next step. And so health cost, for those of you that are not familiar with it, is our tool where we provide the consumer or anybody who accesses the site information on the average cost of over 150 procedures. And we've been able to do this because of the support from SSIO with the level 3, and we just received the level 4 transparency grant. So that will help us continue to enhance our health cost site and where we, our future vision of this site. So right now we've got over 150 procedures for 50 high volume healthcare facilities and hospitals in the state of Maine. So we're showing, for an example, with an MRI, what the average cost is by all the hospitals in the state, and you can see it, what the average paid amount is. And it's not by health plan at the moment, it's a high level showing you the average cost by healthcare provider. And it's pretty powerful when you start to lay that out and you can see from top to bottom where what the variation in price is across all the providers. Connecting the dots, the value of this, yes, consumers, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but I'll tell you, the policymakers and some of the administrators are using this data as well. So really concrete example, one of the executive directors of a federally qualified health center in the state of Maine was looking at a utilization report for her center, and they found that they were, and so she took the utilization report and she compared it to the cost data that we have up on health cost, and what she determined is their referral patterns were going to the higher cost facilities. And so she has since worked with her organization to change the referral patterns to start referring people to more lower cost facilities. Now, the challenge with all that, right, is you just can't have cost. You need to have the quality piece of that. So that's one of the things that we're looking at integrating into our consumer tools is not just the cost data, but the quality data. We're looking at Monarch as one of the resources of that quality data, as well as some other sites. We do have a Monarch tool that's up. That's populated with our hospital inpatient data. And then we also, wearing my main quality forum hat, have a patient experience of care website, which provides data on patients' experience. I think this was talked about earlier this morning, the presentation around what consumers are looking for. And this effort is where we've surveyed primary care and specialty care providers using the CGCAPS survey instrument, and we're reporting those results on a website. And what the consumers are telling us, and there's a lot to say here and not a whole lot of time, so more than happy to talk about this in more detail, but we've created this consumer advisory group, and they're helping us think about how to take all of these consumer tools and integrate them. And that's the real goal of our level 3 and level 4 grant work, is to take all this information and figure out how to bring it together in one site, so that the consumer doesn't have to click around to all these different sites and really integrate this information. And the challenges right now that we're working through are some of the methodology behind what drives, for an example, Health Cost 2014. So when we look at what's the methodology behind how we pull the cost information, there's a lot of challenges and work that we need to do around, are we looking at bundling? Are we looking at total cost of care? Are we looking at reporting at only the procedure level? Attribution with the providers. Attribution with the, it goes on and on and on. And again, this is the work we're doing with our consultant. A lot of the foundation is there. We just need to take it to the next level. And again, that's the work we're engaged in now. So again, our future state of our consumer tools is to bring this stuff together. I think one of the benefits that we have in the state of Maine is our legislative construct is such that there's huge support and legislation, laws that promote transparency. And so when you have that as your foundation, it's a lot easier to do this stuff, but there are still challenges. In fact, we're dealing right now with a potential question around antitrust, and it was discussed earlier today, and I hope we get into that a little more. I've been working with our legal folks, and I mean, I think it's the exact opposite. I'm not an antitrust expert or a lawyer, but from what I can tell with antitrust, what we're trying to do by getting information out there is to foster competition, which is what antitrust wants. So, you know, I think we all need to stick together on that because I think that there are those that want to make it an issue around antitrust. We talked about the consumer advisory group, hugely important. And a lot of the feedback that you got earlier, or we all got earlier this morning about consumers and what consumers want, I would say this consumer advisory group would agree with a lot of that, but I would also say if you're going to do this stuff at the local level, you've got to have your own consumer advisory group, because they will tell you that they're the only ones that know what they really want, and that whatever national studies are out there, that's not what they want. And it's hugely time consuming to work with this type of a group, but it is, I think, incredibly necessary and valuable because at the end of the day, and I'll end with this, and I know I've run over, again, I'm just happy to get out and be with you all, is that, you know, I sit in front of legislative committees when they're in session, all session long, and what they're asking is, who are the type of people that go to these websites? What's the value of them? How do you really know that they're effective and that they're really changing, right? And so we have to be able to answer all those types of questions. We have to show what the value proposition is. Otherwise, the sustainability of all this stuff isn't going to be there. And so, you know, that's one of the things with working with our consultants is we've really wrapped around Google Analytics so we can understand who is coming to the site and why and where they're from and what types of things they're looking at. But all of this stuff is incredibly important because, again, if we're not proving the value, you know, I don't think that we're going to continue. And I think that the value goes well beyond consumer as we define consumer in the more traditional sense, because I think there are all types of consumers, whether it's a hospital consumer or a hospital administrator or a payer or an employer, they are all consumers. And I think they need to be we need to drive them to these sites as well to help change behavior, because I think at the end of the day, what we're all trying to do, I think, is improve healthcare quality and lower costs. So I've gone way over, but thank you.
Thank you. We'll take some questions now. There must be someone out there who has a patient attribution to it.
Oh, thanks.
So, Joe, I saw you have a physician assistant, and it may be what I read is that the majority, and I think it's also in Maryland, that the majority of VA actually practice with specialists and not primary care physicians. And of course, all specialists have offices. Right, offices are generic. Everybody has them. So how do you determine that VA, since, is there, do they say primary care on the taxonomy code, or how do you do it?
So I'm trying to remember, I cannot remember off the top of my head how, what the fourth node of specificity is on the taxonomy code. I didn't memorize that for this meeting. If I recall that there are there are specificities within physician's assistants and nurse practitioners that indicate indicate other dimensions, and we chose the primary care related ones. Yeah, I just can't remember what that, and I didn't actually, in the slide itself, there is a fourth level of specificity, but I didn't include that in there. I think it's a good question about whether or not the physician's assistant in the NPI database gets that level of specificity within it. I think it would be an interesting study, and we didn't necessarily look at it. We didn't necessarily do a full distribution to say what percentage of the attribution was by this type of carrier, or this type of provider, or this type of provider, or this type of provider. I can say that we didn't see that much. And we didn't see that much physician's assistant or nurse practitioner claim activity for the attribution. And partly we know that that's a billing practice issue, where we know that the render may happen at the physician's assistant and nurse practitioner level, but the billing continues to happen at the physician level. And that's, that's a whole different question that we can talk about, the whole billing, rendering, provider issue. But
Michael?
Attribution. Have you had an opportunity to go back to patients and say, do you have a primary care provider? And if so, who is it? And then go back and see whether or not your attribution has anything to do with reality, or whether or not it's just a nice construct you put people in.
We have not, partly because we don't have fully identifiable data, so we don't know who those people are, which is one of the issues. I will say that our checks for the attributed population for our project sites in particular included both the carriers and the project sites, where we went back and said, here's your attributed population according to what the attribution fell out as. The carriers validated what we saw based on the PCP elections that they saw, so that was good that they, when we said, here's what we're seeing for PCP attribution based on the data, so we did it by carrier and we did it by facility or by practice site, and they said, yes, that's what we would have expected based on the attribution that they do for their own reporting. So we had that sort of secondary level of validation around that. And in addition, we have in the practice sites themselves, many of them are sophisticated enough where they're getting reporting back from either Medicare because they're in ACO arrangements or from the carrier community because of their contractual piece. And again, that was another validation point for us. So we saw similar numbers, not exact, but similar numbers for the attribution. I think your point is a good one to say, like, at the individual level, this is who we say is your PCP. Would you consider that person your primary care? Not really possible to do with a de-identified data set that way, but we felt a little bit better that we had at least those two external validation checks to say, are we on the right track for numbers, at least for the what you would have seen.
I mean, one of the things that scares the liver out of me, personal experience, is concierge.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have a PCP. I have the best PCP in Chicago, but it doesn't pay me cash.
Yeah. Yeah, and absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, certainly there are absolutely gaps in that stuff. And again, when we looked at the not attributed population, I think that's a valid point. When we looked at the not attributed population, it was that moment where you start to see the analysis come through and you say, oh man, what happens if it turns out that what we're seeing on the not attributed population are people that are just, they're really expensive and they've got all this utilization and what are we going to do about them because we're missing them? We felt a little bit better that we didn't see that the not attributed population, and I think that will vary state to state. I mean, I think we're fortunate to be in a state in which you do, when we looked at some of the survey data that comes in, so the behavioral risk factor surveillance system asks the question, do you have access to care? And we're just a high percentage state that has that kind of access. In other states, I think it would fall out very differently, perhaps.
Thank you.
Sure.
Questions over that one?
Joe,
sure.
First of all, this isn't a criticism. That's great work.
Thank you. You're allowed to criticize, it's okay.
Yeah, so anyway, my particular area of focus is on chronic disease management. And when you've got chronic disease management, you've got often a multidisciplinary team that's responsible for the patient. Have you done any work with regard to specialty attribution and who's making the decision at the point of decision, who's actually responsible, or is that beyond the scope of what you've been working on?
It was beyond the scope of what we were trying to do in this particular analysis. I think it's a very important point for practice, though. And a lot of what this group, and again, it's hard because you sort of tailor some things to the project at hand. In this particular situation, the practice sites that were part of our accountable care project in particular generally existed not as some of them were systems that included, we attributed this to the primary care, but they also have physicians within their network and they're working together on those things. So in that way, you hope that those teams are actually functioning in such a way that what we've done in this is looked at the cost and utilization for the population that attributed to those primary care practices across the spectrum of their care. So the costs and the utilization patterns are not the costs and utilizations within the delivery system that they are attributed to, but across everything that they see. And that was part of the eye-opening component of this for our practice sites themselves, because they're used to seeing their population with what they're receiving for care within their practice. What they're not usually used to seeing necessarily was, okay, this is a population attributed to me, but man, they're still using the ER a lot, and I have no idea that that's happening. And those are the conversations that stimulated. So I think there's a lot of validity of saying, okay, now how would you then attribute the next person to the specialist care and bring that back into the team? I think that would be a really interesting set of analyses that just didn't exist within what we were trying to do. But if somebody wants to write a grant, that would be a great next step. Jeff.
I have a question for Karen. And you were talking about the value of who's really using it. Do you actually have any statistics at this point on who is using the various consumer-facing sites that you have?
We do. So for the last couple of months, and we can get more specific on this offline, but we have been tracking because we've set up Google Analytics, and Leanne, Kevin, jump in if I have this wrong, but anyways, we have Google Analytics so that we can see, and it's interesting, You know, I would say that we probably are the ones that are accessing it more right now than the consumers. I go in and I see a lot of people from Cambridge, Mass are accessing, and that's where our consultants are. So anyways, I think one of the big challenges is consumer awareness. So as soon as we get to the point where we feel really good about the site, and that's when we get to our future state, which is another year or so, we're going to do a massive consumer awareness campaign, and we're working with the consumer advisory group to figure out just how to do that. But we're hoping between that and the legislation that's just recently passed, where providers have to tell people about the Maine Health Aid Organization and what we provide for information, that that'll start driving people. And the other thing I think is really important is we need to have access points for the different users. So we're going to have an interface for the consumer, an interface for the policymaker, and we don't have that right now. So it's not a lot of consumers. It's probably more policymakers right now and more internal staff looking at it. But that dynamic's going to change in the next couple of years.
Thank you.
Otherwise, I will be fired. And I won't be able to come back here again. Just saying.
No pressure. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Just a follow-up question on chronic care and looking at different providers and attribution. If you look at something like the director, influencer, contributor model and kind of looking at a portion of care delivered by different providers.
I'm nodding, but the answer is no. It's not something that we've done, but it's something that we've considered doing as an extension of this work, yeah.
Yes, it turned out, we started out several years ago thinking, okay, we're going to tell them to, you know, create each claim this way, and then we're just going to sail through it, right? Yeah. No, it didn't happen that way. So, yes, each one had a slightly different twist. We wound up sitting down with each one of, I'd say, the top 16 or so payers, which account for I think something like 98-99% of the claims in Massachusetts, and we sat down with each one of them on multiple occasions and went over what we saw in their claims, how the method we thought should work worked, and had them tell us what was wrong with the method. And we worked back and forth. In some cases, the carriers did tweak what they were sending, but in more cases, Massachusetts tweaked their logic so that if I'm running it for payer A, I use this logic. Payer B, it's that logic. It's a little sticky, sure, but it gets us there. And we've done that with medical claims, and we're working through the pharmacy claims right now.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I think I'd like to give these ladies a hand.
Good questions too.
Yes, and we're going to move right to the next panel, and we're going to bolt the doors, and we're going to keep moving, and so we can keep the momentum going. Thank you, panel. And the next one.